His hypothesis about all of e-commerce can kind of be boiled down to one pretty simple thing. And that's if you create the best possible customer experience, you'll always win at the end of the day because you move the two most important metrics in e-commerce. You lower your cost of acquisition and you increase your lifetime value of the customer.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. I am so excited to be sharing this interview with you today with Ajay Khouri. Ajay is a bona fide serial entrepreneur. We interviewed him in the headquarters in downtown Washington, D.C. of one of his startups, Urban Stems, which is taking a new and innovative approach to flower delivery. Flower delivery doesn't necessarily seem particularly sexy, but you know that on this show, we love those types of businesses. And Ajay does a great job of explaining why there was such a large market opportunity for his company, the different approach and the logistics network that he has built in order to execute on his vision. And he expands into not only his past, working under Mark Lori at a company that was acquired for over $500 million by Amazon, and his future where he's getting back into the medical and healthcare space, incubating and commercializing new companies with this entrepreneurial skill set that he has developed. A lot of good information, a lot of candor and honesty from someone who's accomplished a lot. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here is my conversation with Ajay Khouri.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for hosting us for the podcast. I was thinking about where to start this conversation, and I thought that what might be interesting is if you could contextualize for us, you know, there's a broad spectrum of things and an ever-growing list of things that get delivered to our homes. Yep. Sometimes they come in a box, could be pizza, maybe a new pair of shoes, but flowers on one end of the spectrum are significantly more difficult than, say, a durable commodity like a book or something.
Yep.
So contextualize for us, what makes delivering flowers nationwide difficult?
Yeah, so our inventory, our flowers, you know, as soon as they're cut off the stem, they die, you know, in about 3 weeks. So, you know, we have an inventory that has a pretty short shelf life, and we want to give as much of that shelf life to the customers as possible. So you have the dual challenge of something that, you know, it's constantly turning over, but also something where it really matters how quickly you get it to the customer, because we want them to enjoy how awesome those flowers are for the longest time possible. So here at Urban Stems, we built this entire new supply chain that essentially goes, you know, from the farm to our warehouses in a really quick turnaround. And then from the warehouses and distribution centers to the customer in days. And that had never really been done before. But what it allows is our customers to essentially have flowers that have come off the stem days later so that they get to enjoy it at their house. But that entire system is pretty complex. I think a lot more complex than we initially anticipated. When we started Urban Stems, we said, what is the best customer experience? Because, you know, this company was founded out of my own frustrations with sending flowers when I was in a long distance relationship. I had bad experience after bad experience. It kind of crescendoed. On the woman I was dating's birthday, I sent her a bouquet. It never came. And I made a very bad mistake of not calling because I was waiting. Yeah, I was waiting for the flowers to surprise her. And the company I ordered from kept telling me it's coming.
Yeah.
So I held off on calling. And by 9 p.m., I finally gave up and called a very angry, understandably angry girlfriend. And after that, after just, you know, four or five bad experiences before that and that experience, I realized there was something wrong with the industry. And, you know, the entire flower industry is based on a 100-year-old model called a wire service. Every single flower delivery site you know, except for a couple startups, including us, are based on that system where, you know, order aggregators take your order. They take a certain percentage cut of the order. They pass it on to something called a flower wire that takes a cut of the order. And then it goes to your local florist to actually fulfill. And so you're paying three different people, which is why you so you know, frequently end up paying a higher price.
Yeah.
But when you look at it from the local florist perspective, they have two streams of orders. They have people who walk in the front door and pay full price and can become a repeat customer. And then they have these online orders that are, they're getting less money than someone walking in the front door. And it's completely branded as whoever the actual online retailer is. So they have no way of contacting that customer, and they have no chance of a repeat customer from them. So for them, they still take these orders because it's a good way of managing inventory. So back to kind of your original question, this is a perishable item that's expiring every couple of weeks. That's hard for a mom and pop to manage, but one way that they can manage their inventory is use these online orders to essentially use what, you know, is about to turn. And but when you look at it from the customer's perspective, you're paying a higher price than you if you walked in the front door, and you're the last priority of the person who's actually fulfilling your order.
Yeah.
And so if you look at online customer satisfaction of all categories of e-commerce, flowers is actually dead last because of that.
Wow.
Yeah. And so my bad experience is, you know, not calling my girlfriend when I should have, withstanding, we're institutional. And so we said, we're going to come in and we're going to create the best possible experience. And so we started from scratch. We built distribution centers, one of which is actually underneath us where we are here. And we essentially built an entire infrastructure to match what we thought the best customer experience was. And that's, you know, beautiful flowers that are delivered days after they're cut off the stem. So they have a really long shelf life. Delivery that happens within hours, and complete transparency on your order. So we take a photo of your bouquet as it's being delivered and email that to you as the delivery is happening. So you see that it looks exactly like what you ordered, and you know when it's happening. All starting at, you know, $40 with free delivery. So better, faster, cheaper than anything that had existed, something that would make people want to send flowers more often. But to do that, we had to build an entire new infrastructure. And so, you know, we dictate what's being grown at the farms well ahead of time. Bouquets are actually made at the farm level, so there's no arranging needed to be done in these, you know, distribution centers that we have across the country. In DC and New York, the flowers are biked out to you within hours. And those are by employees of ours. W2 couriers, actually, we're one of the only businesses in the country that W2 our couriers, and we think it leads to a much better experience because they have, you know, they're part of the family. We have very low turnover with them.
Wow. So what, outside of just momentum, inertia, you know, we've always done it this way to some degree, like what other forces are stopping other organizations from shifting to this model? Because it seems very intuitive, and getting to not only own the whole supply chain is valuable for you as a business, but it does deliver this greater degree of customer satisfaction. Like what, as you studied the system, or maybe you dove in head first, like how did you evaluate that the opportunity existed?
Yeah, I mean, we knew the opportunity existed because there was such low customer satisfaction in this category. And when we kind of took a deeper look and realized the structural reason of why, you know, you end up paying a higher price and you get a lower quality product, we realized there was an opportunity to come in and create a better customer experience. I'm lucky. I was actually mentored by Mark Lurie, who started Quidsy, you know, diapers.com, soap.com, those sites, and then went on to start jet.com.
Yeah, which, now Walmart.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. One of those brilliant people I've ever met. His hypothesis about all of e-commerce can kind of be boiled down to one pretty simple thing. And that's, if you create the best possible customer experience, you'll always win at the end of the day, because you move the two most important metrics in e-commerce. You lower your cost of acquisition and you increase your lifetime value of the customer. And when that gap grows bigger and bigger, you have a more and more profitable e-commerce company that can grow faster and faster. And it's not always obvious, because a lot of times when people have e-commerce brands, they are starting an e-commerce store, they think, how can I use the fact that it's e-commerce to drive as much cost out of the business as possible? And so a lot of people will take away things that make the customer experience better because they're just focused on, we're e-commerce, we're cutting, you know, all the costs out. But two of the biggest costs in e-commerce are cost of acquisition, especially now with, you know, social and search getting more and more crowded. You're just seeing prices of acquiring customers because of the competition continue to go up.
Yeah.
And then the other biggest thing is, you know, lifetime value, how long your customers stick around. And again, with more competition, there's more reasons for customers to churn or try different, you know, brands. So if you do really well with your cost of acquisition and do really well with your lifetime value, you can create an awesome brand and an awesome business. And what investing in your customers does that's not always apparent is it creates advocates. It creates people who do your marketing for you. When they have such a good experience, when they buy flowers online and it's delivered an hour later and it's a gorgeous arrangement and lasts for 2 weeks, people absolutely talk about it.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. And so they tell other people and they acquire our customers for us. So it blends. So we still do, we absolutely do social and search marketing, but it's blended by, the viral coefficient, by people just telling other people about Urban Stems.
And it's actually like precisely the opposite of what got you to start in the first place, because you were talking to a friend about this frustration of the consistent issues getting the flowers where they need to be undamaged on time. Instead, you're like, I'm going to tell my friends that he can use it too. It's like precisely the mirror image.
Exactly. It's a great point. And that's part of, to your original question, that was the opportunity we saw. Everyone just talks about how bad their experience is. So if they actually had a good experience, it'll stand in such stark contrast that they're more likely to talk about it.
Yeah.
And so that, again, that's why we thought it was a great industry. And then obviously with the lifetime value, once you have a really good experience after having a bunch of bad experiences, you're very likely not going to churn. And in fact, you'll order more frequently. So our lifetime value of our customers is higher than that of, the incumbents in this space.
Interesting. So as another, I'm the solid if unspectacular boyfriend who's definitely, there's going to be flowers on Valentine's, there's going to be flowers on a birthday, and then, maybe a pop up in between, a little surprise flower here and there. What outside of like the standard rose is there an appetite for, and how do you, when someone's coming into an e-commerce platform that you're developing, you know that they have the staples that they might be looking for, but you're also kind of responsible for putting other interesting ideas in front of them. How do you think about that from a marketplace standpoint?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what you described is the average male flower sender.
Yeah.
To a T.
Like I said, I'm average.
it's really fascinating. When we designed this business, it was very masculine. The colors, the branding, everything. We assumed that guys were the ones who are buying flowers for, the women in their life. And we were dead wrong. Guys buy when they have to, which is on holidays, on anniversaries, on birthdays. Women buy when they want to. So they buy for everyday occasions. Women make up 70% of our customers.
Wow.
Yeah. It's women sending to other women is the majority of our business. And it's women sending to other women when it's their birthday, but also when they get a promotion or something great happens in their life or someone, they get broken up with. Like, it is a wide variety of everyday reasons why women are sending. And so we try to create a catalog that's, applicable to, those everyday reasons.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of flowers, but we also have really cool plants and other types of gifts that can make someone's day.
And there's also a degree to which when you're making that decision back to being the average male flower buyer, there's a degree to which like you want to get something that's kind of in the pocket, in the lane. Like, I know that this is just, maybe it's only a double, but like we're hitting a double. And then there's a time where you kind of go outside the bounds and try to hit a home run. Are there flowers that kind of fit that profile that are a little off the beaten path, but that's going to, as someone in the industry, you can maybe educate me, help me get from a 5 to a 10.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we have a lot of like staples that have roses and, just the mixes that look beautiful, but with components that you've seen before. You might see some of them in the supermarket. You might see some at a florist. There's, they're just common flowers, but put together really, really well. Those I'd say are like the doubles. They're awesome to get.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have kind of, we have a collection that are designed by the Vogue editors.
Yeah.
And those use kind of stems that you may have never seen before, that you may have only seen in some kind of, celebrity wedding on Instagram. So those have such unique combinations of really gorgeous flowers that are very rare, put together in a way that's can only be described, as Vogue,
yeah.
as just ultra premium and ultra avant-garde. And that's hitting a home run. Those bouquets, especially for those who appreciate, which is, I would say, most people, most of our demographic really, really love that.
Awesome.
The Going Deep podcast is underwritten by Piper Creative. Shooting, editing, and publishing quality content is overwhelming. We make it easy so you can save time, build your brand, and grow faster. Say hello at pipercreative.co.
So moving into a little bit later stage of the business, after raising a Series A, you're now over 100 people. You have built out this distribution network. What's really interesting is kind of the phrase, like, what got you here won't necessarily get you there.
Yeah.
And there's maybe a little bit of naivete, maybe a little bit of hopeful optimism as you're getting things off the ground. And then as you start to put systems in place, you know, your role changes within the organization, as opposed to touching everything. You now have entities kind of running these different sections of your business. What have you learned from a management perspective, from a leadership perspective, negotiating going from, you know, two guys in a dream to 100 person national outfit?
Yeah, and a really great question. I think the general rule is that every time you double, it's a different business.
Okay.
And I found that to be pretty true. And I think I've, you know, a lot of the other founders that I spend time with find that to be pretty true as well. You know, you just get to different processes. When we were, you know, as you say, two guys in a closet, we were in a windowless basement closet, driving around in my co-founder's Scion, making deliveries ourselves. You know, we did everything. We put together the bouquets, you know, we did the marketing ourselves, you know, we did the website ourselves, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Today, now that we're a big organization, our tech team wouldn't even let us come near the code, you know, like, and they certainly don't let us get near the flowers. Like, I'm not great at creating arrangements, but we have a team that does that, yeah, that are awesome at it. And so you go from, you know, doing everything yourself to, you know, every time you double, letting go of certain responsibilities, which can be tough for a founder.
So doubling, so we're saying, take me like 50 to 100 or 10 to 100, because that's like a very interesting range where there's a lot of, like, this show bops a lot around the startup scene where maybe they got a seed round, maybe they're like somewhere, you know, we're going from 4 to 10, 12 type of range. But that next step can be something of a yawning gap for some people, whether they can't necessarily find that funding, or once they do so, there's a significantly smaller pool of people with real perspective on what that entails.
Yeah, well put. And it's so funny because I think in the entrepreneurial community, everyone's just so focused on raising that next round, getting that funding. You know, the common phrase you'll often hear is like, oh yeah, once we like raise this money, we'll be good.
Yeah.
And that is never true. I mean, to borrow from a much quoted song lyric, like "Mo money, mo problems." Like it really only becomes more complicated when you raise, and it's very necessary for a lot of businesses, but it's not the solve all that I think entrepreneurs think it is when they like finally get that Series A or finally get that Series B. You just turn into a different business and generally a more complex business. So you know, to answer your question, when you're 10 people, you're all generally in one room. And you're all kind of tackling, you're all tackling problems together. You're coordinating very, you know, tightly. You hopefully have people on your team that are experts in different areas, but you're still kind of charging up that hill in lockstep.
Yeah.
When you're 100 people, you're essentially just managing people.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're at 100 people, you're just managing your management team. And that's what a lot of your time goes to, is you know of the problems, but your main concern is making sure the people who are overseeing the people that are tackling the problem have the tools that they need and are set up for success.
How do you go about getting the information you need? Because there's always metrics you can look in, you know, your Google Analytics or your financial dashboard, but there's a unquantifiable, what's the culture, what's the pace, what's the haps, where's the problem that hasn't been seen? How do I, you know, anticipate something that might be coming down the road when you start to have that gap? Because I have a small team. We're talking every day in WhatsApp, in person, voice memos, you know, reading someone's body language, and you have a finger on the pulse versus, you know, at 100 people, that seems tremendously difficult. So how do you stay in the know, I guess? Or is that even possible?
I mean, it's very necessary. It's hard. It's very hard, but it's very necessary. And so here at Urban Stems, one of the things that, you know, our new CEO has done that, you know, we borrowed, he also came from the Quidsy ecosystem.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Mark really pushed that, you know, we've borrowed from, and I think is one of the best things any company can do, is build a dashboard that has about, you know, I'd say 200 metrics on it. Everything from, you know, the very basic stuff like top line revenue, to more granular, like revenue per city, revenue per distribution center, to costs, fulfillment costs in each area. And then, you know, break it down into conversion on each, you know, main page of your site, mobile versus desktop. You know, you just, you build out every possible metric, both on the cost side, the revenue side, the marketing side, all of those things, so that you have it all in one page and you review it every week. But on top of that, we have HR metrics as well. And so, you know, we have tools that we use that are great that, you know, measure employee satisfaction, engagement, those type of things. But we also track on a weekly basis retention, both with our core staff and, you know, our couriers and fulfillment staff and everyone. And so we look at kind of, we try to capture everything that's going on in the business in numbers and continuously add to those metrics so that we have a complete holistic view of how the business is doing both internally and externally as well.
Makes sense. Any particular tools that you're like, this is just any other entrepreneur in a similar or you know, business in a similar stage, they gotta check out a specific dashboard or tool for doing that?
Yeah. I mean, we built everything we did internally. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. But we use other tools like CultureAmp to measure certain metrics with culture.
Gotcha.
And there are plenty of great tools there that I think you can use and then plug it into your own, you know, dashboard.
Gotcha.
I'm not sure. I don't know if there is a tool out there. And for those listening, looking for an idea, maybe this is it.
Yeah.
There isn't, you know, ours is built on a really complex Google Doc. But if there was a way that you could kind of replicate what is, I think, being done at a lot of e-commerce companies, especially any of the companies that came out of the Quidsy, you know, diaspora, which is a lot of successful startups.
Yeah.
They all have their own home-built dashboard. So if someone wants to commercialize that, I think that's actually a really good idea. Yeah.
Mark Lorry is a great person. If he's saying that that's what people should be doing, I can see why people would take that as gospel. So on that Quidsy point, you mentioned bringing in the new CEO
yep.
for Urban Stems, and that has opened you up to pursue actually two new ventures, one a replacement for opioids, one a light to help solve migraine headaches. This is kind of a return to the medical, pharmaceutical, healthcare space from this flower diversion that you had for a period of time. Take me through, let's just start with why pursue two things as opposed to one?
It was the opportunity. It's the chance to affect a lot of people and help a lot of people. So my dad is a neuro-oncologist. He's one of the foremost migraine experts in the country.
Okay.
And he's dedicated his entire life to solving pain. It's something that's both on the migraine side and on the pain side is not well understood. And today our solutions are very imperfect. On the migraine side, even the most commonly used drug, which my dad helped develop, is effective for less than 50% of migraine patients. And about 40 million people suffer from migraines. It's way higher than
I had them in high school.
I'm sorry that you did. It's
yeah.
There. I mean, you know, how was it when you had one?
Utterly debilitating.
Yeah.
You literally laid in a room in the dark and like I'd have friends who are like, oh, you like fake six, like you didn't have to go to school. I was like, no, I literally just like laid on the couch for an entire day or two and did nothing.
So this is, I mean, and it's crazy to me that, you know, something that debilitating where you have to go lay in a dark room for a day or two.
Yeah.
Is something that still exists in this day and age when we have so much, you know, we've made so many advancements in medicine. Yeah. But migraines are the third most common illness in the world. And the consequence is what you just described, where people's days literally end. And so when we learned about this technology coming out of Harvard that potentially could help people in a big way, it was hard to say no to, you know, going in and helping him commercialize something that could help, you know, millions and millions of people.
Exciting.
Yeah.
And then the replacement for opioids.
Yeah. So that came out of some research in Cambridge that, you know, essentially when you take drugs today, if you have pain in your pinky, you have to get if you take a pain medication, an aspirin or whatever you take, you have to get a concentration of that drug high enough in your bloodstream so that it gets to your pinky to solve that. But in doing so, you get a high enough concentration in your bloodstream where you have that, you know, drug acting at all other parts of your body, your kidney, your stomach, et cetera, which is why you have side effects, and which is why a lot of, you know, people don't take their drugs. With migraines, for example, pharma compliance, so the number of people actually take drugs for their migraine is less than 50%. As you just described, it's debilitating. You know, why wouldn't you take drugs? Because the side effects are that bad. And these guys and my dad have found a way to deliver medication directly to where your nerves are transmitting pain and stop it at the level of the nerves without getting into your bloodstream, which is just a complete game changer. You know, it obviously still, you know, this is something that is a drug that's in development and goes through the FDA process. So there's still a lot to figure out there, you know, but once approved, it becomes a complete game changer for treating pain, and something that, you know, because it's only going to the nerves and not to the bloodstream, doesn't have it's much harder to get addicted to it, which is, you know, if we're able to create a non-addictive, more effective pain medication, that's something that helps a ton of people and solves one of the biggest epidemics that's plaguing our country right now.
Yeah, easy to see why you would get excited about that one as well. So we did an interview last year with Craig Markovitz, who's currently in CMU's entrepreneurial program as a professor, and he had a very successful company itself and helps a lot of entrepreneurs with university technology transfer. So these kind of patents or ideas or research that comes out of university, and there's a scientist or a technologist behind the actual innovation, but it needs basically a steward with that kind of entrepreneurial meta skill set to then take it to the market, commercialize it, which is, those are two very different skill sets.
Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about how you, what you've learned kind of bouncing across a couple of different industries, you know, selling flowers, selling an opioid alternative, or any other realm.
Yeah.
What are the kind of meta universal abilities that you need to have as an entrepreneur to be able to thrive in those different types of environments?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it really just comes down to people, because you know, when to your original, you know, point about what is it like with 100 people, you're not coding, you know, you're not putting together arrangements. What you're doing is you're leading a bunch of really incredibly smart people that are experts at what they do, and coordinating them and making sure they're all pulling in the same direction. One of the best pieces of advice I've ever gotten actually is from one of our investors, Kevin Plank, the founder of Under Armour. He said, you know, find engines and point them in the right direction.
I like that.
Yeah. And like, if you have the right people, they're going to be chugging along and pulling the rest of you. And if you have a group of them and they're all going in the same direction and they're all pushing forward really fast, that's when you can really create something special.
Is there a particularly bad piece of advice that you hear for finding engines? Because that piece of advice presumes that there are engines in the stable ready to be taken out.
Yeah.
Is there you're not going to find any engines if you go looking at X?
I don't know if I've heard any bad advice actually around that.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly, like, not everyone is an engine. Sometimes you interview people and they seem great. And I think part of where we've, you know, fallen into traps are we meet someone who's, you know, really great in the interview process, but needs a lot of direction when they start, or just, you know, wasn't who we thought they were when, you know, during the interview process. So I, you know, another piece of great advice that I've gotten from a fellow entrepreneur is look at, you know, past performance and only past performance when considering a candidate. So really trying to dig into, you know, what happened at their previous jobs, what happened at their previous roles. Were they, you know, if they had jumped around a lot, was it because other people kept trying to steal them? Or are there, you know, large gaps because they left because they weren't, you know, succeeding? There's a book he references, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but I'll give it to you so you can link.
Yeah, yeah.
Link to it. They say their company solely bases their hiring decisions on that book. And it boils down to past performance is the best predictor you have of how they're going to do at your organization.
Exactly like the opposite of the stock market. Past performance does not predict future success, but when it comes to people, it's a pretty good indicator.
It's the most reliable one we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. This has been awesome. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and we've already blown through our half hour of time that we were supposed to have for the interview. So before I kind of wrap up with this and last two questions, anything else you wanted to share today that I didn't give you a chance to?
No, there's nothing else.
Okay. Beautiful. So to wrap things up, I want to make sure that people can keep up with everything that you have going on, both here at Urban Stems and then these other two exciting startups that you're incubating. What digital coordinates can we provide people who want to learn more about all the pots that you have your hands in?
Yeah, I'm one of those guys who, even though I was one of the first people ever on Twitter, I think I have maybe 10 tweets over the past 12 years. And so I don't use it, but I am at AJ Corey. But feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, or I'm also just AJAY at urbanstems.com.
Beautiful. We're going to link all that in the show notes. GoingDeepWithAaron.com/podcast is the place to find it for this and every episode of the show. But as we do at the end of each episode, I want to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
Yeah, mine is quite simple, but actually really effective. It came from another founder. I keep a journal next to my bed, and every day before going to bed, write down three things that I'm grateful for. And generally, it's fairly specific. So it's something that happened that day, a person that I interacted with that day, whatever it is. Just, you know, three to four, or however many you want to do, just write down what you're grateful for. Doesn't matter if you ever read it again, just the action of doing that makes you feel more grateful and makes you feel happier. It's so simple. When I actually first heard about it, I was like, okay, I'll just, before I go to bed, I'll think about these three things. And there's a major difference between just thinking about it and writing it. Once you put the pen to paper, it has an effect that I can personally verify has increased my own personal happiness and gratitude, and how, you know, I deal with the people in my life I'm lucky to have around me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's almost like going to the gym, but for your brain, but like practicing the muscle of being grateful, and then you can call upon that later.
I actually didn't think about it that way, but that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
We just went deep. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Hey, thank you so much for listening to another interview with AJ. There are two great interviews in our past that you need to check out to build off of what you just heard. Episode 340 with Craig Markovitz, as I mentioned in the interview, is all about commercializing and spinning out technology developed at universities for a broader audience for the private sector. He explains that beautifully. It is a very educational episode. Further, AJ is one of the few guests that we have had on that is not from Pittsburgh. We're expanding out a little bit on this show. And if you want to hear another great DC entrepreneur, check out Alan Gannett. He both has a keynote from the Going Deep Summit that you can find on YouTube, and an interview that I conducted with him about a year ago. All that is going to be linked in the show notes. You can find it by checking out our YouTube channel, and appreciate you spending the time with our content, with our programming. We sincerely hope that you found it valuable.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.